Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening on this beautiful white winter day. It's good to know you're out there. Story County Emergency Coordinator Keith Morgan is going to be giving you some reminders about safety during this weather. We were lucky around here, weren't we, that Mother Nature waited until Iowa caucuses were over. At KHOI, we had a whole team of reporters who had driven down to Des Moines to report on the candidate parties as part of our national coverage on caucus night, and I'm really glad that they didn't have to drive back in the snow that happened last night. As station manager, I just wish to express how proud I am of all the members of the KHOI team who gave us live on-the-ground coverage of this amazing night and who have been working for the past few months to record people, places, and events that made up this historic caucus season in our home state. Special congratulations, too, to our own Local Talk's Greta Anderson for her debut as a national anchor. And thank you so much, all of you who came by the station on caucus night. We loved having you here. Lots of people pitched in, and other people just added to the good cheer and the fun of community on a night like this. And most of all, if you listen to us on caucus night, thank you. As always, it's your listening that makes this all meaningful. KHOI was heard on radio stations around the nation on Monday night. We were doing national coverage, but of course, your ears are the ones that matter the most right here in Central Iowa. On Sunday evening, the night before caucus, we had a wonderful guest of honor in our little station. It turns out that KHOI's chief engineer and board member, Paul Nelson, had a late dinner with Richard Bender and brought him over to the station later in the evening. So who is Richard Bender, you might ask? Well, Richard Bender is the person who actually started Iowa caucus night as we know it. Well, maybe you already knew this, but I did not realize that Iowa First in the Nation caucus night originated with folks right here in Ames. What a great opportunity to record an interview with a historic person. So Paul Nelson and I sat down with Richard, along with Mr. Tom Beale, and asked him to tell us what happened and how was Iowa caucus First in the Nation night created. I want to share some of what he told us. I hope you enjoy his story as much as we did. In the wake of what we just all experienced and while caucus night is still fresh in our minds, it's a great time to appreciate this amazing event, caucus night, that we all just experienced together. We asked Richard Bender to start from the beginning, and so he started his story by reminding us that there have always been caucuses in Iowa, but they did not start out as the grassroots events that exemplify participatory citizenship as we know them today.
Iowa has always had caucuses since statehood. The Democratic Party was a quite new party. It had barely existed statewide between the end of World War II and the late 50s. The caucuses occurred, but the delegates to the National Convention essentially were determined by the leadership of the party chair, or the governor, if we had one, and that's who determined who the delegates were. Before 1968, the vast majority of people who went to the caucuses understood delegates to be chosen by the party leadership.
In the late 1960s, social movements, and especially the Vietnam War, split the Democratic Party. This resulted in a change of leadership in the Iowa Democratic Party, and this included Richard Bender getting a job.
In 1968, there were two factions. Some people would say anti-war faction and the regulars. And in 1968, about 70,000 anti-war people turned up and overwhelmed the regulars. And they got to elect new members of the Democratic State Central Committee, the governing organization of the Iowa Party, in early 1970. New leadership came in. Cliff Lawson became chairman from Ames. He owned a grocery store on West Street, campus town. He was strongly anti-war, but he also talked to both sides. And he had me come aboard as one of his staff people, the other being his wife, Marlene. came to Iowa as a graduate student in biochemistry and got heavily involved in the anti-war movement. Iowa State University President Parks told me I was majoring in troublemaking. And, you know, Cliff and I became friends in that effort. And that's how come I got that job.
And what kind of a staff person were you?
Jack of all trades. I did most everything except I didn't raise money.
The new leadership in the Iowa Democratic Party set the stage for the introduction of sweeping changes in the caucus process.
The modern Iowa caucuses was basically and truly an accident of history, born out of two different things that very much angered the newer, some would call them anti-war Democrats.
Bender explained that two events in particular were the catalyst that sparked the desire in the new Democratic Party leadership in Iowa to create change.
At its 1968 Iowa State Convention, the platform committee was appointed by the state chairman. It had been set up that the anti-war plank was to be voted upon as the last item of business of the convention. So when that item came up, and the vote seemed to me to be fairly close, the chair of the convention, amidst calls for a roll call vote, announced that the minority plank had lost and the convention was over. Bang, bang, bang. That upset a lot of people.
And the minority plank
was the anti-war plank.
Which was to end the war in Vietnam.
And a plank that said that the Democratic Party supported ending the war in Vietnam. And that was shut out.
The second event that provoked sweeping changes occurred shortly after the new management of the Democratic Party had arrived.
The Polk County Convention occurred, which chose the delegates to the state convention. They were going to choose 453 delegates to the state convention. And since the regulars had three more votes than the newcomers, they proposed a slate that contained 450 regulars and gave the newcomers the choice of picking any three people they wanted. That was not viewed as very fair, and that created quite a bit of anger. Similar events had happened in Woodbury County and at Wapello County in earlier years. This was not a rarity that you had, you know, one side frozen out. And in 1971, I attended a meeting of what's called New Democrats in Marshalltown, a statewide meeting, and we talked about basically what had happened in 68, and there was a lot of people who were very much in favor of proportional representation. I brought a set of proposals to Cliff Lawson from the Marshalltown meeting, but also my own thoughts, and he decided that what would be best would be form a committee to go over the proposal, call for proportional representation, and to have all of the committees of the party elected from below. In other words, the platform committee and the rules committee and other committees would be elected by the caucus attenders at the precinct level, the county convention, and then at the conventions going upward, they would appoint to the next higher level.
So it would start at the grassroots.
Grassroots.
In the caucuses.
Right. So that would basically solve both problems. By proportional representation, you wouldn't have one side with a very thin majority getting almost all the delegates.
I'm Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for being with us today. And you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And what we're talking about today is very much a Central Iowa story. We're speaking with Richard Bender, who is the historic founder of the Iowa Caucus, First in the Nation process that we all just went through recently. Mr. Bender has been explaining how in the late 1960s and early 1970s, as a result of division in the Democratic Party, triggered mostly by the Vietnam War, led to a new leadership in the Democratic Party. Cliff Lawson in Ames, who was the new chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, appointed a committee to build a more democratic, inclusive system for Iowa caucuses. Here is where the first accidents of history that Mr. Bender mentioned began to occur. The first accident of history had to do with the question, what really was the purpose of the caucus?
The original idea for the Iowa caucuses was not to necessarily divide by candidate.
As mentioned before, factionalism and people being shut out was one of the main reasons that change was desired. And so splintering within the party was one of the first things they wanted to address.
There was a concern that we didn't want to have people split up on hot button issues. We didn't want little splinters. It was decided that we would propose that you could only divide by candidate.
So the decision to divide by candidates wasn't originally meant as a quasi-primary. It was meant as a way to keep the caucuses from breaking down into divisive factions.
Right.
Yep.
But surely when you did this, you must have realized at that point that this was going to become, in a sense, the referendum in Iowa on candidate.
Well, people, you know, most people understood that their role as being a delegate was sort of an honor. And people weren't going with the expectation that they would actually affect policy. They were going, you know, because, you know, that was something that active Democrats did. The desire was that in a spirit of democracy from the bottom, the desire was that the people attending the caucuses basically truly be the people who would decide who the national delegates would be. And it would not be simply a slate created by a few leaders at the top and then rubber stamped by the convention.
So you were thinking about delegates
decided from below.
But did you in any way see this as a referendum on the candidates themselves?
Well, we were aware that this would create a situation where there would be basically a referendum on the candidates in Iowa. But remember, no one had ever paid much attention to what happened at the Iowa caucuses.
What did the rest of the country care about what Iowans did anyway? So, at a time when division in the Iowa Democratic Party was happening over issues and the desire was to reduce division, focus was shifted to the topic of candidates. Actually, not candidates, but to the topic of delegates for candidates whose jobs were then to move up through the system of regional, state, and national conventions.
Delegates were elected at the precinct level for the county convention. The county convention elected delegates to the state convention. You had to elect the committees of the convention from below. You can't elect committees of a decent size from 99 counties. The committees would be huge. So we had to create district conventions, congressional district conventions, as an intermediary stage.
To narrow it down. This abstraction would then prevent divisiveness. But it also created a lot of bureaucracy and logistics and meetings, which take time. That's when the second accident of history came into play.
The actual wording of the platform and the rules of the convention would have to be mailed out to the delegates in advance. All of this took time. You had to gather the people. They had to make decisions. They had to write their documents. They had to be duplicated. They had to be mailed. They had to be received in advance by a week, I believe the rule was. And all that, so we had to have 6 weeks between each level. And all of a sudden, we were very early.
Because you were trying to make time for
narrowing down process. To happen.
The fact that this requirement to make all of this information available at each level, I think the state convention...
It was in June. It was very close to the end of the legal limit for when the National Party wanted to have, you know, the delegates named. We started, I think it was January 24th, if I remember correctly.
Right. That pushed the Iowa caucuses to first in the nation.
Yeah.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg. And we are talking about the origins of the Iowa caucuses as we know them. Mr. Richard Bender is the founder of the Iowa caucuses as we know them. Our chief of operations, Paul Nelson, who you also hear in this interview, brought him in on Sunday night, the night before the caucuses, to tell us the story. There is a saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Not to compare this to that statement, but maybe it can also be said that the road to significance is paved by pragmatism. Just a thought. Seeking a more democratic process for the caucuses through grassroots participation of ordinary citizens. At the request of the state chair, Bender and some other Democratic Party leaders had crafted a set of proposals for change that were not only idealistic, but also pragmatic, proportional representation instead of appointments by party leaders. Richard went on to tell us how he ended up being the point man for this change.
Harold Jews, a senator from Iowa and former governor of Iowa, had been quite supportive of the idea of requiring proportional representation on the National Commission. But the National Commission had rejected that proposal. Hughes, in 1971, was interested in running for president. So while he had been for it at the national level, he was quite strongly against it being implemented in just Iowa, which would damage his presidential prospects, or certainly be embarrassing in that effort. So he called up Cliff Lawson, and he basically said, basically forget this proposal or rework it so you don't have this problem. And Cliff basically said that, no, he really couldn't do that. It had gone too far, but he would not propose it. He would let the kid do it. I was the kid. I was 26. It was viewed that it would have less weight coming from staff as opposed to the chairman. And when we walked into the Iowa Democratic Party Central Committee meeting where the vote would occur, it was pretty obvious that a number of calls had been made from Washington suggesting that this proposal might not be the best idea.
How did you feel proposing it?
I felt very good. We were all very strongly in favor. All four of us were very – this was a unanimous view of the four.
So do you remember that moment fondly?
I do. I felt a little nervous because – When we walked into that meeting, before the meeting got started, it was quite clear that a number of calls had been made from Washington, and a number of members of the Central Committee had decided this may not be a very good idea.
And did you know that you were crossing the Senator Hughes?
Absolutely.
Were you scared?
I would say I was nervous.
So what were your professional ambitions?
Well, I really didn't know.
When Cliff Lawson sent you out there to make this proposal, did he pat you on the back and say, I'm behind you, or was it kind of
oh,
like...
Oh, yes. No, he was all for it. I mean, he was all for it, and he had made calls in support of it to various individual members of the committee.
Okay, so a new way of running the Iowa Democratic Party is being proposed, and the kid is being asked to make the proposal. Now, this is where things get even more interesting, because then he made another decision, a decision which also continues to resonate even today.
The party would not want to have a situation where the voice of the party would be seen to be represented mostly by the students who had come out in huge numbers in 1968. So in about a two-minute thought, I decided to suggest that we would not count the caucus attenders. Instead, we would count only the delegates elected at the county convention. No counting for purposes of spreading to the press the preferences of the actual attenders of the Iowa caucuses. We only report the results of who the county delegates were elected to be in favor of, because the Iowa party leadership would not want the students to have a outsized voice in the way people looked at, what the Iowa party meant.
The actual number of people who showed
is not what's counted.
So there's no real popular vote. It's a representational
vote. It's a representational vote, nor is the attenders are representing their precinct as opposed to themselves.
And that was to mitigate the kind of aversion to the influence of students.
Well, the idea that one group would have a huge attendance and would be unfairly weighted how they represented Democrats generally.
And that was your suggestion?
That was my suggestion. The morning of that meeting where they approved the procedure, and that picked up enough votes that we passed the proposal with not a vote to spare. And that insertion into the process is still used today.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I have been speaking with Richard Bender, who is considered the founder of the Iowa State Caucus process that we have just experienced recently. Again, Mr. Bender came by KHOI Community Radio with He is longtime friend Paul Nelson, who is a board member here at KHOI, and took the time on Sunday night to explain to us how exactly this all happened with a change of leadership in the Iowa Democratic Party at the end of 1960s and the beginning of 1970s. A new way of running caucuses was proposed. Due to a number of pragmatic decisions made by the committee that proposed the changes, as represented by Mr. Richard Bender, a new system was approved, and in 1972, it began. Iowa's first in the nation caucus night, featuring proportional representation.
In January of 1972, I was the sole person doing the counting of all the caucuses in Iowa. We had two phones at Democratic headquarters. I borrowed a calculator, and we thought about getting a third phone, but the phone company wanted us to pay, I think it was $40-some for a phone, and we didn't have $40. We were really poor. We set up a phone tree. Precinct committee people called county chairs, and the county chairs were instructed to call the state headquarters four times through the night. And then as the numbers came in, I sat there with a calculator and did, you know, worked out the math. And Cliff and Marlene, Cliff Lawson and his wife Marlene, who was also on the party staff, hosted the 10 or 12 press people that came. There was no radio. No TV people came. The Des Moines Register called in for the result. They didn't come. 10 or 12 reporters came, all from papers. One of them was Johnny Apple of the New York Times. One was Adam Clymer, then of the Baltimore Sun. And as the results came in, I calculated them.
So starting with the first caucus that you did,
in 1972, people noticed. Oh,
people
yes.
People noticed.
Yeah. But there was only about 10 or 12 reporters that came. Jimmy Carter came in early 75, maybe it was late 74, after the elections, and he had a meeting with me and the chair of Polk County. You know, he asked about it, and he seriously explored it, and thought Iowa was a place that might allow somebody like Jimmy Carter to really pull this off.
So Jimmy Carter wanted to know what the caucus process was?
How it worked, what we thought his chances would be. You could basically camp out in the state, go to numerous meetings, become well known. It was a doable operation. Didn't require a lot of TV buys. I mean, there's no way Jimmy Carter could have raised the money to be in all those media markets. And there's no way you could just roam around and meet enough people in a big state like Florida to have a serious impact.
So he liked the grassroots quality of it.
He did. And he thought that might be a real chance.
He saw a potential
right.
in that.
If you had a
as an outsider.
Right. If you and he was a peanut farmer. Well, peanuts, we don't grow those in Iowa, but we do farm in Iowa. And, you know, he figured, well, I'm a farmer. You know, I might be able to, you know, be attractive to some of these folks. Really allow grassroots politics to really work. And nowadays, we do, as I think Iowans know, have more than a few ads on TV and radio. But still, even with that, a significant part of the impact of the caucuses is a candidate going around and directly talking to voters, which I think is a real service to, you know, to the American public, to start the system off where there really is a chance that somebody who's not one of the top one or two, three people that the national money people and key leaders thinks are the ones, but somebody who has some credentials but doesn't have the resources might make their views known and might actually be successful in this process.
And was Jimmy Carter coming to talk to you the first time you realized that?
We kind of knew that, you know, Iowa did get some attention. And we were aware that there would be probably more attention come 76, but we never dreamed that it would become as big as it did.
That's Richard Bender, founder of the Iowa First in the Nation caucus process. describing the beginning of the Iowa caucuses in 1972 and the realization over time that through a series of pragmatic decisions to really improve the functioning of the party and to unite people more, a team of Iowa Democrats located here in Ames in central Iowa had really put together more than just a meeting process. They had put together a process that would then go on to affect the entire nation. Mr. Bender was kind enough to come into KHOI last week and explain this whole historic event to us. And, of course, at the end of the interview, couldn't help but ask him what this meant to him personally and what insights he could share after being somebody who had really affected change. So you're proud of what you did?
I'm very proud. You know, it's not like it was done on purpose. It's a situation where grassroots people really, truly had an impact on the way presidents are elected. I think it does represent a real opportunity for Americans to have a group of relatively knowledgeable, and Iowa caucus attenders are very knowledgeable political people, to a greater proportion than almost any other group of its size across the nation, really take care, think about the issues, you know, and, you know, make some decisions which start the process.
It's actually relatively rare that a person or a group of people do something that makes change happen.
It is true that most people don't do things that really affects, like, the nation as a whole. I mean, a lot of people do things that affect certainly their family, their community. And I think it's sort of fabulous that a small group of people in Ames, Iowa, was able, with the help of some others, to do something that truly has had an impact upon the nation.
What do you think it was about your group that you were able to make such an impact?
I think a lot of it was right time, right place. You might say we caught the wave with, frankly, some good ideas, some skill in working out, political skill in working out how to actually build the coalition to put it together, the human connections combined with being at a time when people were looking for the change that we were proposing.
And the human connection part you're talking about, do you think that was uniquely Iowan?
Cliff was, in some ways, very much part of the establishment. And his philosophy, a philosophy which he inculcated into me to adopt, was always work it out, find agreement, rather than, you know, just push forward with your views and knock the other guy off. That spirit, which I think is very much, you know, an Iowa spirit, is something that very much helps. I think Iowans tend to give a little more weight to ideas that move forward rather than purely to the structural position of the people making them. I think Iowa allows people to move forward and have their views considered to a greater degree than in many places. And hold
because I cannot find the word. In that church of birch and pine, the only word that comes to mind is beautiful.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And it is my pleasure to be with you today. My name is Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm your host for this hour on this beautiful white winter day. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being with us. KHOI reporter Kay Puttock is here with Community Service Appreciation, a segment which we do every month where we highlight a community service in Central Iowa.
My guest is Betty Bocella, who's the volunteer coordinator for the Retired and Senior Volunteers Program of Central Iowa, or RSVP. Welcome, Betty.
Thank you, Kay.
Do you want to start off just by telling us how your organization works?
I certainly will. Central Iowa Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, and that's a mouthful, so we do say RSVP. We have been here in Story County for 43 years. Which is a surprise to many people. We've been around that long. Back in the early 70s, a group of seniors in Story City actually wrote the original federal grant to start an RSVP program here in this county. So we, to this day, our main office continues to be in Story City. And 10 years ago, we acquired Marshall County, added that to our service area. And 3 years ago, we acquired Hamilton and Webster counties. So Central Iowa RSVP is actually now four-county service area.
Okay.
I office here at our satellite office in Ames with one other staff person. And probably the main thing that we like people to know is that RSVP is sort of like a broker. We're the middleman, so to speak, in that we recruit, screen, and place people 55 and older to serve as volunteers in nonprofit organizations, health facilities, schools, and public agencies. So every month we have new volunteers that contact us and want to look into some of our opportunities. And as we get requests from some of those agencies and schools, et cetera, then we can help match those volunteers Sure. with the needs in the community. And right now we have approximately 600 volunteers here in Story County. And as I said, we get new volunteers every month. I'm very proud of our volunteers. We have very highly skilled volunteers from varied backgrounds that can be placed in many different kinds of opportunities. And it's interesting, Kay, we find that some people that decide they want to volunteer may say, I don't want to do anything like what I've been doing for the last 40 years. I want to do something completely new. And then we have other folks that say, you know, I've done this and this for the past 40 years and I like it. I kind of want to keep doing that. We have a pretty good idea of what's out there in the community in so many different places that it's fairly easy to place volunteers.
So you can match. I just wonder if you could list the kind of skill sets.
Well, for example, we do like volunteers that may have some data entry skills. That's mm-hmm. a request we get for fairly often. People that have other clerical sorts of skills, answering the telephone, meeting and greeting the public, people who like to work with specific populations, whether it's children or older adults. Those require specific skills. We have a very interesting program in the schools called Speak Up, and I'll just use that as an example. It's a public speaking curriculum for fifth mm-hmm. grade students, and one would think that a volunteer would need to be very comfortable with public speaking, but not in this particular case. They do need to be comfortable working with children and assisting them through this eight-week curriculum in developing a speech and presenting it. So there again, that's just an example of being comfortable working mm-hmm. with a certain population. Our transportation program, very obviously, people that drive and have a good driving record are very valuable to us. Sometimes we need medical background folks, those special skills. Mm-hmm. One thing that I do within my job responsibilities is help recruit volunteers for public health emergencies. So I'm always looking for retired nurses and doctors and lab people that can help with public health emergencies.
Now, your special area is
Yes.
public safety and disaster preparedness.
Correct.
Right.
Yes. So what does that mean? That means that I work with the Ames Police Department, Story County Sheriff's Office, ISU Police, American Red Cross, and Story County Emergency Management just in their day-to-day functions. If they need volunteers, I help recruit, screen, and place those volunteers. We have a team of senior volunteers that are the fingerprinters at the Ames Police Department. Oh. Every Tuesday and Thursday, for anyone from the public that needs to be fingerprinted, we just started, just yesterday, in fact, a new volunteer opportunity at the sheriff's office, scanning thousands of files, inmate files. So those are just a couple of examples of the day-to-day kinds of needs that public safety or emergency agencies might need. Your name's very familiar to people are floods and
right.
the people that show up to sandbag. I have a team of volunteers ready to go at any time, and we use Ames City Auditorium. That's where we set up the staging area for volunteers to check in and register. And then the non-emergency phone bank is set up right outside the auditorium in the hallway. An 8-line phone bank system falls down from the ceiling. We set up tables and we're ready to go to take non-emergency okay. phone calls. So that same concept with the volunteer reception center and non-emergency phone bank, I have pre-trained volunteers also in Story City and Nevada. And hoping to start recruiting in Huxley so that we have 4 major population areas in the county covered to provide that service. The Story County Sheriff's Office contacted me a little over a year ago and asked if there was a way that we could provide some resources to help manage volunteers in the event of a missing or abducted child. And so I've been involved with a staff team from the sheriff's office this past year and setting up that staging area and helping process volunteers. In this case, all those great volunteers who show up to help search. And we've seen on the news how hundreds of people, sometimes thousands, come out to help look for a child. Here in Story County, we have pre-trained 25 senior volunteers to be tip hotline operators. So they've been trained by the Story County dispatchers, and they've learned how to take tip phone calls. Mm-hmm. In the event of a missing child, law enforcement has to get so much accomplished within the first hour or two.
Yes.
And if we can come in and help relieve them of having to deal with volunteers that are starting to show up, it really helps them be able to address those priority things that they need to right off the bat. And that's something there again where most people don't think senior volunteers would ever have a chance to get involved in that way. But those opportunities are happening here mm-hmm. in Story County. So if anyone has any questions about anything I've shared today or and beyond public safety or disaster preparedness, please call our Ames office at 515-292-8890.
Can they drop by your office too?
Certainly. We're open Monday through Friday. Our address is 110 Crystal Street, which is just off South Duff Avenue.
Behind the Mucky Duck.
Behind the Mucky Duck Pub.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Betty.
Thank you, Kay.
Bocella, who is the volunteer coordinator for this area for Story County of the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program. Thank you very much, Betty.
Thank you.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio on a beautiful white winter Wednesday. KHOI reporter Gail Seiler is here with Keith Morgan, the Story County Emergency Coordinator. And Keith is here to give you some reminders about safety, especially during this winter weather.
Keith comes in once a month to educate our listeners and us about what we need to be aware of in terms of staying safe. And today we're going to talk about safety in winter months in particular. Is that right, Keith?
Hello, yes, and I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's always great to have you. I always learn things. If you could start talking about when people are just at home, in this time of year, what safety things do we need to be aware of?
During the winter time, obviously, one of the primary ideas or things that we're worried about is staying warm on it. And in the winter time, people will tend to use alternate heating sources. Maybe they need to heat up just one room or the power's gone out and they're using some alternate heating source. And those can be, if they're not properly managed, they can create a greater risk within your house. One of the main things is, just as I said, if they're not managed and if they're not monitored, then things can go wrong with them and create a fire hazard. Unfortunately, up near Boxholm, we had an example of that. So when somebody is using an alternate heating source, the first thing is to make sure it's in good repair. If it's an electrical cord on it, make sure the cord is in good shape. Don't string it along using multiple extension cords while you're setting it up. Keep the area around it so that nothing will touch the heating elements. Create a fire that way. Very importantly, make sure that it has a tip-over feature, which will automatically shut off the device if it does get tipped over. Another thing people sometimes don't think about is CO, carbon monoxide. When the oxygen is used up within a room and carbon monoxide levels build, this can cause people to become disoriented and they don't even realize that they've gotten into a dangerous situation.
Right. So, people often think they have the flu or something.
Exactly right. Yeah. And the situation tends to get worse. They get more disoriented and then they can't take care of themselves. Summertime, wintertime, it's always a good idea to have a CO monitor. They're just like a fire smoke detector also that'll set off an alarm if the CO levels in the house become too high.
Mm-hmm. And just going back to the alternative heaters, I always wondered if the newer ones they make are safer. Is it when people are using older styles or older ones that were made a longer time ago, are those more dangerous? Are they safer now?
They are getting safer with the inclusion of items such, again, as the tip-over features on them. And they're making them so that there's more screening around them so that the hot elements are more difficult, but still, things go wrong with them. The rheostat may be faulty. No matter how well they're tested, you might get one that is just the bad one out of the lot. Mm-hmm. So that's why we say always have somebody monitoring it. Don't leave them in a room for an extended period. Don't go to sleep with one of them running.
Right. Okay. And anything else having to do with the home?
Look around your home. If there are storms coming, make sure that you've got, especially if there's going to be high winds associated with the storm, anything that can blow around, make sure that that's secured. Make sure that the vent, your furnace is also, the vent near it is well clear of any snow. And if there are any branches or any tree damage that has occurred, if you can safely try and remove those limbs so that they're not hanging over your power source, that's a great idea.
Okay. And then Iowa's a big state with a lot of roads, and people often are out on those roads in winter. What can you tell us they should be aware of?
If you know that the roads are icy or if the weather is coming in, the first question you really ought to ask yourself, is this trip really worth my life? Evaluate that. Now, some of the sources that you can use to evaluate that is go online. National Weather Service has got an excellent website that you can put in your zip code or the zip code that you're going to and look at on the right-hand side of their main page. Once you go to your local area, they have an hourly graph of what type of precipitation is going to be occurring, when it's going to occur, how much is going to occur, and winds, all that stuff to really educate you. Iowa also has an excellent 511 site, which is you type in 511 in your search engine, 511 Iowa, and it'll show you what the road conditions are as they were last reported, though. You always have to understand that these are the reports have to come in for them to be able to post. So the road conditions may have changed since the last time it was reported, but it still gives you a good idea on what's happening with the roads out there.
So that's a National Weather Service site and the Iowa 511 site.
Exactly. Type in Des Moines National Weather Service, and it'll take you to our local site. And again, up in the top left-hand corner, you can put in your zip code and get very, very specific weather data.
Okay. And so what else do we need to be thinking of out on the roads?
Again, make sure that your car is prepared. And before you even walk out the door, is your cell phone fully charged? A lot of people are using their cell phones all the time. They walk out the door and they have hardly any charge in it. You want that cell phone completely charged. Let somebody know where you're going to, when you're supposed to get there, and what route you're taking. people say, well, I've got a cell phone, I can call in. But if something should happen to you, if you should slide off the road and be knocked unconscious, you want somebody to know to start looking for you and where to look for you to make it a lot easier for them. Make sure that you've got hat, coats, glove. Dress like you're going to walk to your location because you may be walking to your location, which leads to another issue on it. Typically, we recommend folks not to leave their car if they have an issue.
Right.
Last year, we had a death up north of us because there was an elderly couple that decided to get out of their vehicle and walk. Usually, you can stay warm enough if you've prepared your car that you can survive until somebody can find you, which goes back to letting people know how to find you by giving them the route that you're going to be taking. So those things all come together to make it so that you can get through this bad situation until somebody can find you. But if you're in the car, another thing to think about is I've got this full tank of gas. I'll just run the car and stay warm. Well, out east in the recent snowstorm, we lost some lives because people didn't make sure the tailpipe was clear. This goes back to that carbon monoxide. The car couldn't get rid of the carbon monoxide. It backed up into the car, and people became disoriented and unfortunately succumbed to the carbon monoxide. So run your car 10 to 15 minutes out of every hour. Have one window slightly cracked so that there's fresh air. And most importantly, before you start that car, get out and make sure that the tailpipe is clear.
Okay, so those are some very specific things that people should remember.
And every time before you go and get in that car, if the weather's bad, think through these things.
Okay. All right. Anything else about traveling?
No, really. That's the main thing.
There's a lot there. And then what about if people are outdoors doing other kinds of things?
Iowans like to get outdoors in the weather. And one of the first things, again, is let somebody know where you're going to go and how long you're going to be out. If you fall, you break your leg or something like that and you cannot get back, you're probably out in the wilderness, so your cell phone may or may not work. So start off with a fully charged cell phone so that if it does work, you can get hold of somebody. Take something like a whistle so that if people are out looking for you, they'll be able to hear you. Make it so that they know where to look for you. Let them know when you're leaving, when you should be back, and where you're going to go to. Obviously, dress appropriately for the conditions you're going to be out in. Layering is very, very important because if you are out there, you're going to be exerting yourself. You'll be creating sweat, which can make your clothes damp. And then when you stop moving, that same dampness can be a real hazard to you. So layer, try not to allow that sweat to get into your clothes. And again, let somebody know where you're going to be at. Watch your fingers, your toes, your nose, your ears, your cheeks. Those are the areas that are most susceptible to frostbite. If they've started stinging and then you don't feel them anymore, you're starting to get into a dangerous situation and you should probably try and get to some sort of heat.
That's bad. Yeah. And does this recent, because we've had some pretty warm weather in the past week and that now it's getting cold again. Or when you have that change in temperature, does that make going out on ice more precarious? Or what do people need to be aware of there?
Well, there's always a risk going out on the ice, and you're correct. We've had a lot of large fluctuations, so that it's good that people should get really good information on the ice levels if they can and really educate themselves on how to tell whether the ice is good and solid.
Okay. And what if you're at home and there is a storm and you lose power?
Well, one of the first things to do is obviously let somebody know. You may always assume that somebody's let the power company know about it. Folks that live out in the rural areas obviously are more prepared for this. But the first thing is to try and just bundle up. Stay warm as long as you possibly can. You know, if need be, try and snuggle next to somebody and share off of their heat. Again, going back to these alternate heating sources, you might check if you have a gas fireplace. Will that work? Because that is designed to be used and is vented properly. Using ad hoc other heating devices, stoves and like that, not recommended. They're not designed to be a heating source. Mm-hmm. So if in worst case situation, if it's going to be an extended period, try and get to someplace else where there is heating, a friend's house, something like that. And again, if you have an alternate heating source that you do intend on using, make sure somebody's monitoring it at all times.
And some gas fireplaces work without electricity, but some require electric ignition. Is that right? So they wouldn't work if there's no power?
I would check it. I check mine, and it does actually work. It does have a blower system, which makes it more efficient. That obviously wouldn't work.
Right.
But the last time the power went out, I checked it to make sure that it does actually work.
Okay. That makes sense. And what should people be aware of with pets or outdoor animals?
Oh, there's two sides to it. There's your pets, the domesticated animals out there. They have to have some place to get out of the moisture and out of the wind. You know, the wild animals have their dens. You need to make sure that if your animal is going to be outside, that it does have the capability to get out of the wind and out of the moisture that's out there. Water sources are another important thing. If putting a bowl of water out there isn't going to work, if the temperatures get lower, that'll freeze up. So you need to make sure that the animal also has adequate water. And it's colder outside. They're going to need a little bit more food to be able to maintain that temperature. For the livestock and like that, same sort of things. Make sure that they have somewhere to get out of the wind, that they're adequately fed, and that, again, that you have a water source for them.
So you want to create a warm and safe and dry den for animals, but also for yourself,
Exactly. Wherever
you go.
Whether you're in the car, whether you're at the house, everywhere you go, you need to be thinking of those same sorts of things.
Okay. This has been really helpful, and we hope that it helps our listeners stay safe through the upcoming remaining months. How many more months are we dealing with this kind of weather? Another month and a half, would you say?
Groundhog Day will tell us on that. A few years ago, we had snow all the way up into May.
Right.
This is Iowa. It's very difficult to tell. But soon enough, when we're back in March, we're going to start talking about severe weather awareness and tornadoes and high winds. So it's it can be a very dangerous swap over when we're going from winter to summer.
You've given us a lot to think about and be aware of. I've been talking with Keith Morgan from the Emergency Management Agency of Story County. Thanks for coming in, Keith. And we'll hear from you again in March. This was your February visit, but you'll be back next month.
I will, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Gail, and thank you, Keith. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you ever so much for joining in today and listening to us. And I have been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, with pleasure. Kay Patek has also been here speaking with Betty Buticella, Volunteer Coordinator for Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, otherwise known as RSVP. And earlier in the program, we heard an interview that was conducted here at KHOI last Sunday on the night before the Iowa caucuses, and we were speaking with Richard Bender, who is known as the official founder of the Iowa First in the Nation caucuses as we know them today, and he gave us a little history in democracy and the history of the Iowa Democratic Party. Always a great thing to know while we are coming off of the excitement of the Iowa caucus night. Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., and you can also listen to today's show in its entirety and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And there you will also find information and links to the people you heard on the show today, along with any other contact information that's relevant. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means that you can be part of our team of volunteer reporters. We'll send you around with our little cell phone technology that is very cool. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or through our website at khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And remember that your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible and absolutely meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.